Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Programming note. I will be out of town for the last week of January. I'm participating in a YouTube show called Taking Off with Dan Milliken. As such, this will interrupt my flow as I was going to start the Pedestal series this week. So what I'm going to do instead is continue on with the regular series in North Africa, and when I get back, we'll then cover Operation Pedestal and then head back to the Eastern Front, where, if I remember correctly, we left off in late January 1942, and that's where we'll pick up the story. So, if you'll be in Fort Worth, Texas the last weekend of January, maybe come by and say hi. I'll be posting my locations. Now, on with the story. Hello, and thank you for listening to The History of World War II podcast, episode 402, Monty Sets the Stage for Rommel. While the British Royal Navy moved heaven and earth to get Pedestal underway, this massive convoy, though only partially successful, dovetailed with the Americans getting involved, not to mention more fighter planes being placed on Malta. So while Pedestal made it possible to only half-starve the people for the rest of the year, the aggressive nature of the Allies was returning to the Mediterranean. In June, the Axis lost 6 ships. In July, they lost 7. In August, the month of Pedestal, it was 12. Basically, as the Near East Command was beefing up, Rommel was receiving less and less of everything. Still, he was determined to attack and perhaps take some fuel from the enemy. How's that for 2 birds, 1 stone? Indeed, Rommel had already written to Berlin. He needed more of everything. What was eventually making its way to him did not even compensate for daily usage, much less building up a reserve. To this, the Italians promised him the 7 last ships of the month would come to him. It would be all for him. Rommel took this and decided to change his attack date from August 26th to the 30th. That way he would have some additional supplies. And he had to attack. The Desert Fox was being told of more supplies and reinforcements for the enemy, landing at the Suez. Rommel just needed to get there and cut off that option to the enemy. And as Berlin needed this to work, though Rommel was a pain in the backside to deal with, Kesselring would bring fuel from Crete, and he would give him a few more planes from the Luftwaffe. Rommel was starting to feel better. And yet, of the 7 ships promised to him, the Allies had the bad form to sink 4 of them. This seemed to be the last straw. Rommel told Rome and Berlin of the lost ships, that he was feeling poorly, and they might want to send him a deputy, perhaps General Guderian, you know, someone who could take over if needed. That man, however, was busy on the Eastern Front, so Rommel got on with his preparations, but it must be noted, not with his usual energy and enthusiasm. Meanwhile, on the other side of the barbed wire, Monty was his own version of energy and pluck. First Lieutenant General Oliver Reese of the 30th Corps was given enough men to make each division 3 brigades strong. Also, the men were spread out a bit more to give a greater defense in depth. Lieutenant General Brian Horrocks of the 13th Corps was also given help. His New Zealanders were given a brigade from the 44th Division to make up for the badly mauled 4th New Zealand Brigade. As stated earlier, the rest of the 44th Division was placed on Alam Halfa Ridge, just behind and a bit lower than Ruwisat Ridge, and all those men were behind a most impressive minefield. Now, everyone on the Allied side expected Rommel to swing south, go for about 10 to 15 miles, and then turn north to, one, hit the enemy on the ridges in their flanks, and then do the same to 30th Corps further north. With that, the attackers could grab all the fuel they could find and keep going all the way to the Suez. And, it has to be said, Rommel had, by this point, gotten used to his enemy trying for a while and then giving up. Hopefully, that same pattern would play out here. And now, a mental map is needed, if Monty's trap is to be understood. Having studied all he could of the previous desert battles, Montgomery liked the idea of having Rommel trapped in a cauldron, and the three main ridges in the area would play their part. Though the line in between the two opponents was not a straight one, in the middle of the line, it ran across the western edge of the Ruwisot Ridge, where Rommel had his own mines and tanks placed. Just below the Ruwisot Ridge was the Alam Navil Ridge, about half as big. And behind, or to the east of both of them, and a bit in between these ridges, is the Alam Halfa Ridge. Not only was the 44th Division on that ridge in strength, but they had an overabundance of artillery. Even better, on the southwestern corner of the Alam Halfa Ridge, there was the 22nd Armored Brigade with its anti-tank guns and tanks themselves cleverly hidden. By the time the panzers spotted them, having swung southeast and then turned north, they, the panzers, would be fired upon almost at point-blank range. But even that was not enough for Monty. The gap between the Ruwisot Ridge and the Alam Halfa Ridge is about 4 miles, just a little too big to suit the new CNC. So he had the 23rd Armored Brigade placed there, ready to go in any direction to help put out a fire. Also, the 8th Armored Brigade was placed to the east of the hidden 22nd Armored Brigade on Halfa's southwestern corner and below Alam Halfa Ridge, again by some 4 miles. The 8th Armored Brigade represented a nasty trap should Rommel get this far. The reason for this positioning was in anticipation of Rommel. Again, if he came at them from the south, as everyone expected him to, then the 7th Motor Brigade and the 4th Armored Brigade, sitting below the New Zealanders on the Alam Navil Ridge, and they were sitting behind a major minefield. They, if the Germans came their way, would simply retreat in good order. That is, until they reached the 8th Armored Brigade. Then, all three brigades, with help from the 22nd Armored Brigade and the 23rd Armored Brigade, a bit more north, might help too, if needed. That was the cauldron. In other words, Rommel's aggressive nature was being used against him, and the trap being set was a large area with massive amounts of firepower by the defenders, with a retreat route that would see hundreds of Allied tanks on Rommel's rear as he tried to get away. But would this work, as Rommel was shown to be a master manipulator and brilliant with his sleight of hand, not to mention having a history of charging into the lion's mouth and snatching victory from the jaws of defeat? When Churchill returned from his visit with Stalin, he could tell for himself how much Monty had changed the atmosphere here at El Alamein. General Brooke noticed it as well and approved. Then Monty gave them a briefing to show how he understood the larger situation and his nasty surprise set for Rommel. It didn't hurt that, at the time, the over-exuberant Prime Minister was already in a good mood, having come from Moscow and gotten Stalin to accept that there would be no cross-channel attack this year. But it had not been easy. Back on August 12th, Churchill took off in a B-24 Liberator from Tehran, Persia, for Moscow with his senior military advisors. This flight took 10.5 hours. Churchill knew that Stalin did not make small talk, so jumped right to the heart of the matter. The British Prime Minister told the Soviet leader that they and the Americans would not be ready for a cross-channel attempt, in 1942. But then, trying to balance out this with some good news, the Prime Minister quickly added on, by the end of 1942, over 1 million American troops would be able to reach the United Kingdom, which would increase their total troop numbers, creating an expeditionary force of 27 divisions, to which the British government were prepared to add 21 more divisions. This all sounded well and good, but if those men were not being thrown into northern France, then what was the point? But Stalin put it this way. He asked the Prime Minister if he and his people were afraid to fight the Germans. Then he said, a man who was not prepared to take risks could not win a war. Churchill could see that his approach was crashing, so switched topics to the Americans landing in North Africa. This, combined with the British bombing of Germany's industrial centers like Essen, should lighten the mood in the room. It did not. But the Soviet premier could see the writing on the wall. His Western partners would not be making a direct attack this year, maybe the following year. And it looked, for now, that the Russians were holding their own. So Stalin said what was expected of him. As for the North American landing, Stalin replied, may God help this enterprise to succeed. Which was lip service, but in diplomatic circles, that's the same thing as a handshake. Their meeting lasted 4 hours, and when it was done, Churchill sincerely felt that he had made a real connection with Stalin, and that was his only goal. And then he blew it. That evening, Churchill went back to State Dacha No. 7, where the Prime Minister told his men that Stalin was a peasant whom he knew how to handle. And that's when the gloves came off, because of course the room was bugged. That evening, at dinner, Stalin was much more colder than the day before, and Avril Harriman, an envoy of FDR, got to watch as Stalin tore into Churchill, complaining about no cross-channel invasion and that Operation Torch did not concern or help the Soviet Union directly. Churchill tried a different subject, the convoys of supplies coming to the USSR. To this, Stalin said, much has been promised, but not much had been delivered. The Prime Minister had had enough. He forcibly told Stalin, Torch would assist the Soviet government and would be the only active military operation that could have this effect in the autumn of 1942. Between this outburst and Churchill throwing another Stalin unpleasant statement back in his face, the Soviet leader was impressed. Bullies always respect strength. Stalin retreated from his unpleasant attitude and asked Churchill, could you stay another day? So the two men went to Stalin's personal residence and were served by his daughter and a housekeeper. The result of this meeting was a joint statement during the early morning hours of August 16th, saying, the Soviet Union, Great Britain, and the US of A would continue to fight against Nazi Germany until the complete destruction of Hitlerism and any similar tyranny has been achieved. Now, hindsight blinds us to the lingering results of this meeting. Stalin had been much more distant with his Western partners before this moment. If anything, each side, FDR and the Prime Minister on one, Stalin on the other, have expected the other side to reach some kind of deal with Hitler and thus leave the other half hanging. But not now. Stalin could see that Churchill and FDR were serious about defeating Hitler and helping Soviet Russia in its hour of need. In short, Churchill's trip had its highs and lows, but it ended well, and that's all that matters in meetings. Back to North Africa, when Churchill left Monty, he wrote in the general's visiting book, may the anniversary of Blenheim, which marks the opening of the command, bring to the CNC of the 8th Army and his troops the fame and fortune they will surely deserve. Rommel could see for himself that the northern half of the enemy's defensive line had been strengthened, which did not matter to him very much, as he knew his real strength lied in his panzers. So he would use them to swing through the southern half and then turn north. And drawing on his own past battles, Rommel would have four mobile columns of armor drive east and then turn north. The most northern part of this axis fan was the column of the 90th Light Division. Below them would be the Italian divisions, the Italian 20th Mobile Corps with the Ariete and Littorio Armored Divisions. And below them would be the Africa Corps, led by General Nearing, with his 200 medium tanks. This, of course, included the battle-hardened 15th and 21st Panzers. But needing as much punching power as possible, Rommel also gathered up his reconnaissance units and brought them together to serve as the last and lowest hanging part of his fan that would spread out as they turned north. The far eastern edge of this hopeful cauldron was manned by, as we saw, 22nd Armored and 8th Armored Brigades. They were under the Alam Halfa Ridge, so had a good chance of being engaged by the panzers. The man in charge of these two brigades was Major General Alexander Gatehouse, commander of 10th Armored Division, and he had 210 tanks, of which 164 of them were the valued Grants. What was about to unfold was another Rommel attack, done the same way that so many previous battles had started out. Now he could only hope that his enemy would do what they normally did when he charged at them, namely by reacting piecemeal, with their armor showing up late, with their artillery taken out, and in the end, the larger overall group of defenders would just sit there and watch as individual brigades were wiped out before the rest of them retreated east. Yes, all would probably play out the same way as it always had, the only difference being Montgomery.